Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
This GX on Agriculture podcast is brought to you by Haas Nissan in Yorkton.
To the people tending the land and animals that feed us and support our community, we at Haas Nissan want to say thank you on behalf of all those who depend on you, the farmer. Like you, we are a family business with family values you can depend on. Haas Nissan, where a handshake still means something.
GX on Agriculture with Rod McDonald.
Good afternoon, farmers. 16 after 12, and welcome to the Thursday edition of GX and Agriculture, where we try to present the good, the bad, and the ugly. Yesterday we had the bad, or at least that's what a group of prairie grower organizations see a seed variety use agreement pilot project as bad news. Let's try to find the good in this. We'll hear today from a representative with the Canadian Plant Technology Agency. The agency is working on that pilot project along with the Canadian Seed Trade Association. We spoke with Lauren Hadley. He's executive director of the Canadian Plant Technology Agency, and he'll explain this new pilot project and why it's not such a bad thing after all. Also on the program today, had a good chat this morning with Jim Everson. Of course, you know him as president of the Canola Council of Canada. And it's been just about a year now since China started putting up all the roadblocks for Canadian canola imports, exports of canola from Canada into China. And initially they said it was there were some phytosanitary issues, right? Everybody thought there was much more to it than that, and probably had a heck of a lot more to do with the arrest of the Huawei executive in Vancouver wanted for extradition to the U.S. Well, it's been just about a year now. Are we any further ahead? I asked Jim Everson that question this morning. And also, apparently that there was a lot of, you wrote a car, there was a lot of talk. And there has been over the past year about the need to diversify our markets because of, well, in large part because of the difficulties with China. And I guess we've fallen on our face, quite frankly, with regards to diversification, or at least that's Jim Everson's take. And he'll expound on that on the program today as well. First, though, the Agriculture Weather Outlook. It's a presentation of Sean Prahika, your REMAX Blue Chip Ag Division Specialist.
Agriculture Outlook with Precision Weather.
Now, Precision Weather with meteorologist Phil Spivak. Did get a bit of a flurry, hardly even worth mentioning overnight, Phil, down in the Esterhazy area, and mainly cloudy this morning in the Yorkton region. What should we expect throughout the rest of the afternoon and over the next couple of days here?
Well, a little more of both of those things, first of all. And then by the end of the weekend, we're going to start to get into a little bit more of a up and down swinging type pattern. But at least for the next 48 hours or so, pretty quiet. There is the cloud cover around, a lot of thin and mid-level cloudiness, so some of it breaking up or at least thin enough to get some sun through. There will be a few more flurries that come through as well for tonight, but most of those are going to be those same insignificant type flurries. And then we just continue our above normal temperatures with a pretty quiet pattern to close out the week. -3 is our high today with the cloud cover. Temperatures are struggling a bit. There's not much wind. And while the wind has its obvious cooling effects, the wind chill, it also helps to mix up the atmosphere, and it's that mixing that allows warm air to move into places where it might not be. And without the wind, you very often don't get the same amount of warming. Now, we don't see that effect as greatly notable this time of year. It's more something we notice in spring, where we'll have a breezy but really warm day, or even early summer. But to us, on a small scale, the same type of thing is true. So temperatures are struggling a bit without much wind. As they start to pick up through the later part of the day, those overall southerly winds will start to get going, and that will help to keep the temperatures up tonight, if nothing else. -3 today, -10 tonight. A few flurries do work their way through. Amounts negligible. Partly sunny sky tomorrow. The flurries should be long gone by morning. In fact, during the day tomorrow, as we break through to that partial sun, we'll make a run into positive territory. The high near 1, and as just noted, a little bit of a breeze helping things along tomorrow. Tomorrow night, partly cloudy, -9. Cloud cover thickens back up on Saturday, and some flurries or even some steadier light snow come in for the night. There actually is a chance for some accumulating snow for Saturday night and Sunday. Though, having said that, it will be hard-pressed to do so at all times because we are going to be above freezing, and the flurries could even mix with some rain at times, especially during the early part of Saturday night and then again early in the day on Sunday. We're right around zero daytime Saturday. We'll likely come up a few more degrees overnight. That's when we get that mixture potential. Then temperatures drop back from around 1 early Sunday down through the minus single digits Sunday afternoon. It'll be a windy day. A little snow, but more wind. That's our bigger headline than the snow on Sunday. Partly sunny sky takes back over for Monday. We'll get some extra cloudiness coming in as the warm air holds on. It actually gets pushed quite far south Sunday night, only to build right back in for Monday, right around zero. We stay above normal, if not above freezing, for the first couple of days of the week, like through Tuesday and Wednesday.
Okay, thanks, Phil. Now, turning to this hour's temperature roundup, minus 11 in La Paw. Swan River, Dauphin, Roblin, Hudson Bay all check in at minus 9. It's minus 10 in Brandon, along with Shoal Lake and Russell. Zero in Regina. Indian Head, minus 2. Broadview, Moosomin, Saskatoon, minus 5. Minus 4 degrees for Wynyard, Wadena, and Kelvington. In the Yorkton-Melville region, it's mainly cloudy. The wind light west at about 5. Relative humidity, 97%. And our temperature holding steady over the past hour at minus 8. Yesterday's high and low, minus 9, minus 16 normals for this date. Minus 7 for daytime highs with an overnight night low around minus 17. It's been warm to the north. I anticipate Jimmy Lake. I shouldn't say that. I don't even know where Jimmy Lake is, but it sounds like it's a northern place to me. And that was the warmest place in Saskatchewan yesterday, plus 4. South End, the coldest, minus 30. In Manitoba, Melitta, minus 6. It was the coolest place in Manitoba yesterday, or the warmest, I should say, in Tituli Lake, the coldest, minus 38. Sunrise this morning was at 20:08, and the sun will set tonight at 6:25. Again, our current temperature is minus 8. It's 12:24 now. It's 25 after 12. Ag Review is next at 12:30. A year later, and not much has changed. The one-year anniversary of China's decision to block canola imports from Canada is approaching, and it doesn't appear we're really any closer to resolving the situation now than we were a year ago. Canola Council of Canada President Jim Everson does give the federal government some credit for trying to make things right.
I think there's a lot of good work going on. I think there's a lot of, there has been technical discussion, and that is improved in the latter part of 2019 and in 2020. I think fundamentally the issue is not one about canola. It's about a broader geopolitical issue. And that China has really targeted canola as a result of a concern over issues that are not about canola. So that's the challenge. If it were just about canola, I think we would have had it solved by now. So I think there's reason to be optimistic, but there's a long way to go yet.
Where government has really dropped the ball, according to Everson, is on market diversification. Everson says actions to support market diversification have not materialized. He says despite dozens of meetings with government, only token actions have been taken.
Regrettably, that we're a year without with this problem with China, and regrettably, we haven't been able to do as much as I think we need to on the diversification side. On the case of engaging with China, I think the federal government is very committed to that, and we're working closely with them. And those discussions need to continue. And we really, we can't get used to in Canada. We can't get used to being blocked in markets internationally. We need to continue to fight for rules-based trade and for market access, but really on the diversification side, we think there's much more that can be done to support producers.
Is it a case, Jim, that diversification is easier said than done?
You know, I don't think so. I think in the case of biofuels, it's something that we're pointing to. The Canadian Canola Growers Association and the Canola Council of Canada together have been asking for some support to increase the domestic fuel supply that's created by biofuels using, you know, canola and soybeans. It's a win-win-win. You know, it reduces greenhouse gas emissions by a considerable amount in our diesel supply. It makes use of Canadian canola, you know, in a stable market for Canadian producers. It's free from this global protectionist action that we see on canola seed, and it builds value added in Canada because it creates the conditions for investment in new processing facilities and value added in Canada. So we think it's not hard to do. There is a clean a renewable fuel standard already in place in Saskatchewan and in nationally, and we don't think it's at all difficult for the government to make a change to encourage the use of agricultural products in the Canadian diesel supply.
If the Trudeau government is looking for something to resonate with rural Canada, they should promote a strong biofuel mandate.
The carbon strategy is not particularly popular in rural Canada. We've seen that played out, and here's why. I think there's not a lot of benefit to it. There's costs, but not a huge benefit. There's some benefit to a biofuel strategy that provides a market for hardworking Canadian farmers.
Everson says canola exporters and the Canola Council are working to diversify exports into new markets, especially in fast-growing markets in Asia. He says government plays an important supportive role and needs to step up to support predictable trade.
There are new markets, and the exporters of Canadian canola are really working hard to make sure that we're taking advantage of them where it's possible as a result of the China blockage. So the kind of markets that we're talking about there are, you know, Pakistan and Bangladesh, Vietnam, Thailand, the United Arab Emirates. Those are opportunity markets for more canola diversification. And what we're asking the federal government for some support on is being sure that our policy people, agriculture policy people, and our regulators have regular interface with their counterparts in those countries. As you know, the issues that we have globally are ones of, you know, regulatory barriers, protectionist measures that governments take. And so if we're going to become more reliant on those markets, I think there's a role there for government to be sure that we have good, close government-to-government relations so that we understand what their needs are and we understand their trends in terms of direction on regulation and so on. And we don't get surprised with a market closure that we don't see coming.
Everson says the shipping delays as a result of the rail blockades have also challenged the canola industry.
Anything that slows down rail traffic is a real challenge, you know, and I think it's the challenge there also is that our international markets, get concerned about the reliable supply and the reputation Canada has in terms of a supplier. And so clearly, you know, any challenges to being able to load boats and export grain is something that's not welcome.
Despite the current market challenges, Everson says he remains confident about future prospects for the canola sector.
There's a lot going for us in the canola industry. You know, we have terrific farmers. We have, a well-financed industry. There's large global demand, significant global demand for our product. You know, we're the largest producers of canola in the world. I think the future for the canola industry is a good one. We've had a very challenging harvest in 2019, and we have this blockage with China. But these are issues that we're going to resolve, and the fundamentals of the industry, I think, are very strong.
Canola Council of Canada President Jim Everson. A little after 12:30 now, time for AgriView, a presentation of People's Machine and Welding in Yorkton.
GX94, AgriView.
A new pilot project will see participating farmers pay a trailing royalty to the seed developer on three new varieties. The Seed Variety Use Agreement is being launched this spring by the Canadian Seed Trade Association and the Canadian Plant Technology Agency. Lauren Hadley is Executive Director of the Canadian Plant Technology Agency.
A prototype that will allow producers to purchase seed of varieties And if they reuse that variety on their farm, they are able to direct a payment directly back to the breeding and distribution developer of that variety.
Seed companies say Canada is falling behind on new crop research.
There needs to be more flow back to breeding institutions to incentivize more investment in breeding in many crops, virtually every open pollinated crop in Canada.
Royalty rates on the three new seed varieties being utilized in the pilot will be set in the coming weeks.
At this point, there'll be two wheats and a soybean. There is a possibility for some more. The plan is for us to run the pilot, work it in the real-world situations, analyze it, evaluate it, and measure it. And as you go through it, we'll take two full seasons before we're able to actually say that the pilot, we know everything about how the pilot operates.
An electronic platform will track purchases as well as the use of farm-saved seed in subsequent years. Meantime, five Prairie Wheat and Barley Commissions, including Saskweed and the Manitoba Wheat and Barley Growers Association, do not support the pilot program. Saskweed Chair Brett Halstead says the pilot is separate from the federal government's consultation process on a new seed royalty structure, which has already generated heated discussions about the right to use farm-saved seed.
There's still an ongoing consultation process which hasn't reached a conclusion, and we're still waiting on the economic analysis, which is supposed to have been coming for quite a while. Apparently we may get it next week. So while the process is still going on to decide a path forward, we're a little disappointed that there's a pilot project.
Halstead is worried such a system could potentially be used on publicly funded varieties.
Those public varieties have been created with producer and government funds, and we think that setting a trailing royalty on anything that's public especially goes against the intent and the spirit of producers putting their funds into varietal development.
The five Wheat and Barley Commissions say it's critical for Agriculture and Agri-Food Canada to complete the consultation process with producers who want assurances that any extra money is used to advance varietal development. The value of primary ag exports from Alberta to other countries declined for the second year in a row last year. Exports fell from just under $6 billion in 2018 to $5.4 billion last year, a drop of about 9%. ATB Financial says the Chinese government's ban on Canadian canola helped push Alberta's exports of the crop down by 33% last year. Wheat exports fell by 13%. On the plus side, cattle exports were up 14%, and higher sales of peas and beans, which jumped by 18%, but they were not sufficient to offset the lower canola and wheat sales. And the federal government wants the Canadian Federation of Agriculture, to develop the Canadian Agri-Food Sustainability Initiative. The aim is to provide farmers and processors with an online national platform to proactively meet the growing demand for proof of sustainability from customers. Ottawa is spending $560,000 on the project. Agriculture Minister Marie-Claude Bibeau says customers of Canada's high-quality food want to know that their food was produced ethically with a minimal impact on the environment. And she says the tool will help build consumer trust for Canadian producers. And that is today's Ag Review. It's 12:37 now. We have the livestock market report coming up next.
Livestock market conditions.
April live cattle futures trading this afternoon at 111.62 a hundredweight, down 72 cents. June live cattle, 104.72, down 30 cents. April feeder cattle, 134.72, down $1.25. May feeder cattle, 136.02, down 85 cents. April lean hogs, 63.40 a hundredweight, down $1.75. And May lean hogs, 70.60, down $1.57. And those are the latest U.S. livestock futures. We'll check the grain prices coming up in about 10 minutes from now at 10 to 1. Hog producers are being encouraged to adopt a disciplined, structured approach to building protection for live hog prices. Tyler Fulton is Director of Risk Management with Hams Marketing Services.
One of the major stories that has, you know, that's not been, that's kind of fell back in terms of a priority of, you know, in the whole pork market, global pork market, is the heavy supply that we have seen in the U.S. We're, you know, easily running at the highest slaughter levels that we've ever seen for this time of year. And for that matter, at this time of year, we typically start to see, you know, numbers start to ease off a little bit. And they've been extremely, you know, quite steady with the highs that were put in December. So they haven't trailed off as much as they typically would, and that reflects the fact that the U.S. producers have been ramping up production, and I think that we're probably still in the middle of that trend where there's really no end in sight in terms of the increases in production that we can expect.
Fulton says the large supply of hogs has kept a cap on live hog prices.
Much more so than I think what was anticipated for this time of year. I mean, most analysts expected to see year-over-year number increases, but I think it was, you know, generally thought that the increased export potential would, you know, would possibly overcome those increases. But because we've been running at production levels that have been a lot closer to, you know, full capacity utilization than what was anticipated, I think that's really kind of kept a lid on cash hog prices, and in particular those hogs that weren't, you know, previously contracted, those, you know, quote unquote uncommitted hogs, have really seen depressed prices, because quite simply there's a lot of plants that are running at full capacity and they just can't handle any additional hogs, and so the value of those uncommitted hogs is really quite low.
On the demand side of the equation, Fulton says,
what we've seen, you know, starting about 2 weeks ago and then again early this week, is severe impacts from the development of the coronavirus, which, you know, has no direct effect on hog production anywhere, but it does threaten export demand. I think there's really, you know, significant concerns about the ability to move product into, you know, into places like China, where the demand is obviously very high, given the losses related to African swine fever. But there's a lot of concern about the grand economic impacts that coronavirus may have globally, and that uncertainty has really put pressure on futures markets early this week, and I think that uncertainty associated to that demand it's really up for question. I mean, we know that there's a massive hole that needs to be, you know, that ideally would be filled partially, at least, by global pork production moving into China, but with the constraints related to the coronavirus, it's really difficult to access that, and so there's a lot of concern just about the ability to move, logistically move that pork into the country, and really the impact that the virus will have on overall demand for everything.
We asked Fulton what advice he has for hog producers for marketing their hogs.
I think this is the time where producers with a plan will really start to, you know, will really, I guess, realize the benefits of that plan. If you have a plan and you stay disciplined to that plan, and by a plan, what I'm saying is a structured approach to gaining protection for your hog prices, and something, you know, something reasonable, something that is not too extreme, and does, you know, and considers the whole picture, which includes the heavy supplies here in North America, the obvious hole that developed from African swine fever in China and other countries, and now the new dynamic of the coronavirus and its impact on that. So I think that producers should probably have lower expectations than what they did, you know, 3 months ago, just strictly due to the fact that coronavirus has the potential to really disrupt normal market signals.
Tyler Fulton, Director of Risk Management with HAMS Marketing Services. It's 12:45 now. A new group called Farmers for Climate Solutions wants more action on climate change, including developing incentives to encourage farmers to adopt new technologies to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. The group, Farmers for Climate Solutions, has members that include the Canadian Organic Growers and the National Farmers Union. Stuart Wells is an NFU vice president. He farms near Swift Current. Wells says members of Farmers for Climate Solutions have a very clear message.
Something needs to be done, and farmers need to be a major part of putting forward the solutions for our own industry. We don't want solutions to be imposed on us. We need to be proposing solutions of our own and working with governments and anyone who's interested in finding solutions. You know, we really feel that we can't just sit back and say we oppose any sort of change, whether that's a carbon levy or anything else, any other kind of measures that are proposed to reduce the production of greenhouse gases. We need to be more than just sitting on the sidelines saying no. We need to be part of the discussion. We need to understand what's happening around us as best we can, and then really be part of those solutions. And so it all gets sort of wrapped up in the title there, Farmers for Climate Solutions.
Wells says agriculture has tremendous potential to deliver effective climate solutions, but economic incentives are required.
There need to be incentives. There needs to be all sorts of government mobilization. That's the only way we're really going to come to terms with this, because none of these issues in and of themselves are easy. If the problem would have been easy to identify and understand, that would have happened a long time ago. And if the solutions were easy, that would have happened a long time ago as well. You know, it's going to be a work in progress, and that's really why we want to be part of the solution, part of the discussion with these other organizations, and we want the input from other farmers and other organizations.
Stuart Wells from Swift Current is vice president of the National Farmers Union. The NFU is part of a new group called Farmers for Climate Solutions. It wants the federal government to develop policies and incentives to support low-input, low-emission agricultural systems. It's 12:49. And time to check the grain prices. A presentation today of Raynor Dean, your REMAX Blue Chip Realty Ag Specialist.
To the people tending the land and animals that feed us and support our community, we at Haas Nissan want to say thank you on behalf of all those who depend on you, the farmer. Like you, we are a family business with family values you can depend on. Haas Nissan, where handshakes still mean something.
Commodities Update.
May canola futures trading this afternoon at $4.5630 a metric ton, down 10 cents from yesterday's close. July, $4.6390, that's unchanged. May, Minneapolis wheat, $5.24 a bushel, down 6 cents. May, Kansas City wheat, $4.53, down 6 and a quarter. May, Chicago wheat, $5.28 and a quarter, down 7 and a half cents. May corn, $3.68 and a quarter, down 6 and a quarter. May soybeans, $8.94 and three quarters, up 2 and three quarters. And May oats, 278 and three quarters a bushel. That's down 7 cents today. And those are the latest grain prices. It's 10 now before 1. Quinoa can be a profitable crop for prairie farmers to grow, but there are some things you should know about the plant. It's still a relatively new crop for Canadian farmers, and considerable research is being done to improve productivity and address threats to the crop. Agriculture and Agri-Food Canada field crops entomologist Tyler Wist is studying insect pests.
Back in, I guess it was a few years ago, I was up in the Meadow Lake area, and they had a few quinoa fields growing up there, and one of the agronomists said, hey, you got to check this out. We've got these two quinoa fields, and one of them is really not doing very well. And so it was July already, and the crop was stunted. It was maybe a foot tall at its highest. And so we went in and split some stems and had a look at it, and we realized that there were a lot of insects that were inside the stem of the quinoa plants. So the next field over that was planted at the exact same time was more like 3 or 4 feet tall, and it had the same insects, but didn't seem to be such a high load of insects in the stem. And so that was my first experience with quinoa as a crop. At that point in time, I didn't really even realize that Saskatchewan had this burgeoning quinoa market. And then we got in touch with a group called Norquin, so that's Northern Quinoa, and they said, you know what, we could really use somebody to identify the insects that are attacking quinoa for us. And so at the same time, Boyd Morey, who was at the time a research scientist with Ag Canada as well, we kind of both started looking at quinoa at the same time and said, well, how about we get together and we'll put a research project in. And so we got a two-year project funded by the provincial government and funded by Norquin. And what we did there is we just basically looked at quinoa over the course of the growing season and identified all the insects that were attacking it. And we identified that there's about 4 insects in the province and probably in the whole growing region of quinoa that have the potential to completely wipe out the crop.
Wist says they're trying to determine the life cycle of those insects so they can make recommendations on how to control them. So what are the insects that are harmful to quinoa?
So the ones that get into the stem, down in the main one, is actually a little fly, and it doesn't have a common name, but it has a yellow head, so we've been kind of calling it the yellow-headed fly. But what it does is it lays one egg, kind of single eggs on the leaves, and then when the larva hatches out of those eggs, it goes straight down through the leaves into the petiole of the leaf and into the stem. And so if you get enough of those, they just completely destroy the stem on the inside, and that can lead to stunting of the plants. And in some cases, when the plants are tall enough and you get a big wind, the plants will just snap off. So we originally identified something called the goosefoot groundling moth, and that one had a common name. And we thought that it was feeding in the stem, but it was only in the stem a little bit. But what they were doing is they were actually up in the seed head, and so they were destroying the seeds in the seed head. So what Boyd did was he said, well, you know what, it's a moth. We can develop a pheromone for it. So we got together with Kirk Hillier, and he's a professor at Acadia University, and he does things like develop pheromone lures, and we actually came up with a pheromone lure for this goosefoot groundling moth. And so now we can use it to monitor the presence and of this moth across the growing region of quinoa.
Wist says there are also some beneficial insects that are attracted to quinoa.
The typical beneficial insects that will get into quinoa are your lady beetles and your green lacewings, kind of the typical beneficials that'll attack any other bad insects. But the trouble is, when you're hiding inside the stem, most of our generalist predators can't get to them. So the goosefoot groundling moth, as a larva feeding up in the top, they can get attacked by things. But inside the stem, the little stem boring fly, so that yellow-headed fly, has a really easy time escaping predators like that. We also found a weevil that was in the stem too, and kind of wiped out production down in the south the southeastern part of Saskatchewan. So kind of those three are really bad. And we also realized that some pests of canola actually like quinoa as well, which was kind of shocking. But the Bertha armyworm, which is a big pest in canola, really likes quinoa, but we realized that it also likes lamb's quarters, which is very similar to quinoa. So that's another one of the potential big bads in quinoa. And then early on at the cotyledon stage, so that's a really early growth stage, we had crucifer flea beetles feeding on these cotyledons. And so there was this other little bug too in the family Myridae, and it's more of a piercing sucking pest, and it was leaving these stippling marks all over. So we're not sure if that one has the capacity to wipe out a crop or not, or slow it down, but they're out there. So that crucifer flea beetle doesn't have a whole lot of natural enemies. This myrid bug, it's kind of like a plant bug. It probably has just generalist beneficial insects going after it. But we did find a couple of parasitoids of that goosefoot groundling moth that was feeding up in the top. And we may have some potential parasitoids of those stem boring flies as well. So the project wasn't really looking at the beneficial insects. It was more looking at the pest insects. So this is a system where there's a lot more research that could be done.
It seems like we have a lot to learn about quinoa. Until we do know more, do you think it's too risky for farmers to grow?
The payoffs, though, for quinoa can be really high. Like, if you get a good crop, it can really pay off for you. So I would say that the benefits outweigh the risks. There are going to be some risks with growing it. There is some research, though, and looking at control of these insects. So at the moment, there are no insecticides that are registered, except for one against the kind of Bertha armyworm goosefoot groundling moth, and it's a biological insecticide. But they're doing some minor use work out at Scott and trying to come up with a couple of other pesticides that will work against these goosefoot groundling moth, but hopefully also against all of the insects that are in the stem. So that research is forthcoming, and that will make growing quinoa a lot less risky.
Tyler Wist is a research scientist and field crops entomologist at Agriculture and Agri-Food Canada in Saskatoon. And we'll close out our program with GX94's precision weather forecast for the Quill Lakes, Hudson Bay, Swan River, Broadview, Mooseman, Indian Head, Yorkton, Melville, Roblin, and Russell regions. Cloudy, 40% chance of flurries. This afternoon, wind west or south-southwest 10 to 20, high minus 3. Cloudy tonight, 60% chance of flurries. West wind 10 to 20. Overnight low minus 10. Partly sunny tomorrow. West southwest wind 15 to 25. We'll shoot for a high near plus 1. Cloudy Saturday. Southeast wind 10 to 20. High 0. 60% chance of flurries on Sunday. High again near plus 1. Partly sunny Monday. High near 0. On this hour's temperature roundup, minus 11 in the Paw. Minus 10 degrees in Brandon, along with Shoal Lake and Russell. Minus 9 in Swan River, Dauphin, and Hudson Bay. Minus 5 in Saskatoon, along with Broadview and Mooseman. Minus 4 degrees for Wynyard, Wadena, and Kelvington. Indian Head, minus 2. Regina, 0. In the Yorkton-Melville region, partly cloudy, the wind is light, west at about 5, relative humidity 97%, and our temperature minus 8. That's our time for today. Join me again tomorrow afternoon at 12:15 for GX on Agriculture. I'm Rod McDonald.
CJGX, a Harvard radio station serving Saskatchewan and Manitoba. We are GX94.